It's all about us, and it's time to bow down. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Bow Down. And Dennis, it's so great to see you. Thank you for being here with me today and spending this time. I look forward to it as always.
Yes, as always. And you are looking beautiful and radiant as ever, Queen.
Just, thank you so much.
As I always say, it's so great to have this time to commune a little bit together and talk about today's fun things. So, you know, today, really excited to talk about the television show Severance. So if you haven't watched it, then go watch it because you should watch it. And then come back and listen to this. But if you have watched it, I think we're just here to share what we've noticed and through our unique lenses. So
absolutely.
Really happy to have this opportunity. It's so wonderful.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'll go ahead and throw out there real quick before we dive into this conversation. We are going to get into spoilers. I don't want to accidentally ruin any bits of this show for anybody. So, of course, if this is something that you don't want spoiled before you see it, which I don't think, as someone who has now seen the show, you absolutely do not want it spoiled for you at all. Going into it blind is the best way to go into it, if possible, with this show, because now it's kind of become a cultural phenomenon. And I'll also throw out there, yes, it is on Apple TV. And it is another streaming service to purchase. I will say, I did the 1 month free trial with Apple TV, binged the whole 2 seasons, and then canceled. Haven't paid for Apple TV and have watched Severance. So if the cost is a thing, I get it, but I'll throw that out there that you'll probably binge it really quickly because it's really good. And there are loopholes for those willing to find them.
A little bit of a life pro tip there, I think.
Yeah. Awesome.
But
yeah, I think we're just going to dive in. And obviously, with the theme of this show being all about empowered womanhood and spiritual womanhood, I think a great starting point is just the women of Severance, the women in this TV show. Dennis actually was the first person who, or not the first person, but the person who finally pushed me over the edge to go watch it. And I was immediately drawn in. And one of the things you said was, there's this one character that is like a strong woman character and you just have to watch it. And opening it, it's like immediately I know exactly who you're talking about, and it's so fascinating. So yeah, what's your reaction to the different archetypes of womanhood we see in Severance?
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting what I noticed having watched it now several times, well, twice. In general, I think I've seen every episode at least twice now. And I think my views have definitely shifted over the course of the second season in particular. To me, you know, the two characters for me and are so Helena and Heli are certainly to me very interesting sides of the same coin, and particularly how we feel about Helena versus how we feel about Heli. And I think there's a lot to explore there. I also think Miss Cobell, Miss Selvig, Patricia Arquette, I think, does such a wonderful job.
So talented.
Actually, all of the actors in this ensemble, I'll say, are just ludicrous. I mean,
yes.
They all, it's like, just give them the Emmy right now, right? And it's hard to, you know, you could pick out any performance and say, what an outstanding performance by all involved. But, you know, and really the third, I mean, there's some other minor female characters. Obviously, Gemma / Miss Casey is a third archetype, perhaps. And then there's a few other female characters that are more minor in terms of Devon and Gretchen, I think. And I don't know if there's any others that I'm
Natalie.
Yeah, Natalie. Oh, how can I forget Natalie? That's another great point. And of course, Miss Huang as well.
Yes, yes.
Who's younger and, is sort of a, to me, a younger Miss Cobell. So, it very interesting to notice these different things. But yeah, I mean, it's interesting because I would say my favorite character on the show is probably Helly. So Helena's Innie, to me is the character who I find myself most attached to, which for me to enjoy a television show, mostly I there needs to be some character that I personally relate to, attach to, in some way am invested in, and it can be difficult for me in shows that don't have that
Yeah, I
to
agree.
really get into that for me personally. And not every other people are story driven. I have a difficult time when there's no characters that I can relate to. And for me, Helly, I think is the most relatable. What I also found interesting though is sort of the dichotomy between Helena and Helly and all the complex emotions that came up watching the show, because Helena is an empowered woman in one sense. I mean, she's the CEO in waiting. It's not really clear if she's the acting CEO, frankly, because it's not really clear what her father does or doesn't do, and what his day-to-day role is, or if he's even him, which we might get to a little bit later. Like, who is he? So on that side, you sort of have boss girl, right? Girl boss kind of thing, where she, and frankly, she is not a very likable, is not presented to me as a very likable character. But then I wonder why. What really, if you look at her actions, she's done her job. I mean, basically, we may not like her job, we may not like Lumen, we may not like the company, but why do we, I don't, why do we feel antipathy towards her, or at least me, why did I? Because of her basically doing her job. So that's and being powerful. Was it simply because of that? And it's just something to explore. I don't know, what did you find, Reese?
I think one thing that I didn't really clock in to until because of course I went down the rabbit hole watching all of the YouTube videos and fan theories and Reddit forums and
Oh,
all of
yeah.
the things. How can you not? It new hyperfixation for me. But was that we didn't get Helly's outie narrative, and we don't see much of Dylan or Irving's outie either until later on in the season. But we do not see Helena until the season finale when Helly wakes up and it's like, holy shit, Helly's outie is an Egan.
Right.
And I think that that was done very, very purposefully to make Helly automatically the viewer is in her shoes because she is the only one. She is learning the process of Lumen. She is learning what severance is, what the severed floor is, how this all works. And we're kind of just as confused as she is going through it in season one, because it's like, as she's learning the rules, we are too. And I think that that's a really beautiful strategy that the writers and producers took here to have this kind of one-to-one foil for the audience, right? That it's like, if there is a character we're supposed to identify with, it is absolutely Helly. And I think any of us would probably jump to that, get me out, right? Like, I don't remember who I am. I'm in a strange place. I'm so confused. I'm going to throw this speaker at the head of the person who, if he is not the one who kidnapped me, has something to do with all of this. And I want to go, like, fight or flight activated. For that, there's the thumbs up again from Riverside. I need to
We
find a
like
way to
fight or
turn that
flight
off.
being activated, apparently.
Yeah. But also this idea that that familiarity that we feel with Helly, that identity, I think is even more, we feel this sense of even stronger betrayal when we learn that she is the Egan, because it's like, you've been my gal, like you're my gal Friday. You're the one that has been fighting the big fight, and you're also who we're fighting. Wait, what? And so I think there is this like betrayal in that, but it also kind of asks the audience to look inward and in the different ways that we betray ourselves. That it's like, is Helena betraying Helly or is Helly betraying Helena? I think an argument can be made for either. I think in season two, even in season finale of season one, we certainly start to see this, but throughout season two, I think it's developed more and more. Also, Helena's reliance on Lumen. Like, when you are, it's almost like oligarchy, monarchy more than anything, right? Because Lumen does have this kind of theocratic approach to its rules. The handbook is very clearly supposed to look like a Bible. Like, there's all of this religious imagery throughout the show. And Lumen is like the company that creates everything. It is like the monopoly of monopolies. If you're born into that family, what is Helena supposed to do? It would be like if, is it King George that was just crowned? I'm horrible with the royal family. But if someone in the royal family who was supposed to be crowned abdicated the throne. And I think that even might be taken more gently than Helena saying, I don't want any part of this. Because what, you're not supposed to go down to the diner that's named after your grandfather who was a CEO? You're not supposed to use the medicine that Lumen is in charge of because they started as a pharma company? You're not, like, the roots go so deep that the idea of someone who was raised to not only worship this company, but to worship her position in the family, to know that, like, this is all resting on you. How much of that is her fault? And how much of this is she being indoctrinated into? How much of this dogma is actually hers? And obviously, there is the whole, you know, you don't choose the cards you're dealt, but it is your job as an adult to work through it. And she is an adult. And I would like to see Helena, you know, take some sort of different approach, perhaps. But we also don't have all that much insight into how she actually feels. And her relationship with her dad is so fraught. And also throw out there just as another weird, like, womanhood symbol, the eggs every morning is something I've just been playing around with. Like, mm-hmm. Kier has raw eggs every morning, and Helena has in episode one that we see her eating of season two, eating hard-boiled eggs. And her
It was episode nine. Yeah, right at the beginning.
Oh, okay, right at the beginning.
And then he made the cryptic comment, remember, I wish you'd take them raw. Which again, some people took to be when reading the sort of the forums and stuff, like, was that a sexual reference? But I think, to me, Occam's razor just says, well, we knew Kier took he ate raw eggs for breakfast. That was highlighted. So, but I mean, again, there's no reason. I mean, you can certainly interpret it that way. Yeah. I'm curious, you know, what do you make of Helena, who in episode four of this season, where Irv, you know, sort of uncovers her and sacrifices himself to blow the illusion of her being role playing as Helly, you know, she seems very irreverent towards the whole Kier thing, which you don't really see from the other. You don't see that from Miss Cobell. You don't see that really from even Drummond, you know, in the finale, Brienne from Game of Thrones, I can't remember her character's name, but says, you know, how many more, and Drummond kind of says, you know, however many more the founder requires. So yeah. Again, it feels like she hasn't. My impression was she didn't drink the Kool-Aid in the same way. Helena may not have drank the Kool-Aid essentially in the same way that the others we've seen in the Kier Lumen ecosphere have. I don't know. What does that bring up for you?
Yeah. I think in the Ortbo episode, when we see the, like, most direct Helena pretending to be Helly here, which is also just a whole fascinating thing, right? And she fully is laughing at this story of Dieter and Kier story that we hear here, which also tangent, I saw again in some sort of video that Dieter Egan is an anagram for like AI not intelligence, but like AI human or something. It's not
really.
there's some anagram there that I'm like, that's another fascinating thing. That's like, who knows what that is. But in her like fully laughing at this story, I don't think that Helena has drunk the Kool-Aid in the same way that everyone else seems to have. However, I don't think she's as irreverent as she is kind of pretending to be. I think it's almost a way for her to play dress up a little bit. We see when Helena learns that Helly is Helly and kind of took over her body and is deciding to pretend to be Helly and go back in, that she's studying all this footage, right? She looks at the clip of Helly and Mark kissing at the end of season one. And my idea is that, well, she probably studied all of the footage they have on Helly, right? Otherwise, how does she really pretend to be this person? And of course, she can't fully be someone that she's not. She doesn't have the experiences Helly has. But I think that there's something almost like taboo exciting, like exciting and naughty in this certain way of her being able to play at, I hate this. This is disgusting. This is the worst thing I've ever heard. That's so ridiculous. Without having to feel the natural consequences of that, because anyone from the Egan family, from Lumen, that's watching Helena through footage or whatever, or that knows that she's actually Helena pretending to be Helly, knows that she's pretending to be Helly. So is this actually Helena's thoughts? No, she has a free pass to fully criticize in whatever way she wishes. And so I almost think that reaction, it felt really heavy-handed to me, actually. It felt like an overreaction to something that I was like, in watching it, it's like, that just, it seems, yeah, it's a weird story. It's really odd, but how is that any more odd than anything else we've seen or experienced? And this is the thing that garnered that reaction. I almost think it's like, I don't know if Helena actually believes that, or if she's kind of playing around with how these things feel, with, does this feel right? Do I actually feel that way? Or is it just kind of like when you're allowed, like you get cast as the bully or you get cast as the villain in a play, you get to kind of experience what that side of yourself is in a safe way. And so I think it's given her safety to explore those things. I don't know if Helena's actually come to a conclusion about it yet or not. I think she is very much in this liminal space between the two, which I think speaks to the fact that, you know, we haven't really seen Helly all that much in season two. We really only saw Helena. We're supposed to believe that Helly was put back after Irv tries to kill Helena in the Ortbo episode. I know we've talked a bit. We're both suspicious that that's actually even Helly. And I would argue that Helena has reintegrated. And now, as Mark says in the finale episode of season two, Helleny, we have this reintegration that we see now. That's kind of my thought. So I think it really is about this, like, there's no longer the black and white of Helly and Helena. There is this gray. And I think Helena's character arc has kind of taken on this, is Lumen good or bad? Because yes, they're the ones that have created this horrible, horrible thing. They're the villain in season one. In season two, by the end of season two, we need Lumen in order for the Innies to survive. I don't know who the villain is anymore.
Yeah, that's a great point. And so a lot to talk about there.
I know. I feel like...
So much. Yeah. I mean, honestly, this could be... Like, I feel like we may need two of these and just like have to cut and paste a little bit, because honestly, there is so much to talk about here. So rewatching it last night actually changed my mind a little bit. Not 100% on Helly Helena. But so rewatching it, right after he completes the 100% and we have that absolutely marvelous interaction between the statue of Kier and Milchek, and then we have the, I mean, just mind-blowingly incredible HBCU marching band with Milchek leading. Just, I mean, to me, that's an all-time iconic scene when that band comes
so
in.
So iconic. It's just,
but if, you know, watching it and the band plays, you know, Kier, the Praise Kier song that, you know, that Cobell sang, you know, Golden One Kier, you know, but if you notice something, I watched this several times. So they finish that song, they put up like the 100% with Mark's face on it in cards, you know. But right when that happens, there's the B flat, I think it is, ding. Okay, before, and then it transitions to her, to Jame Egan, walking out of an elevator. But if you watch it, the bing occurs before he goes into the, before the scene shifts to him in the elevator, about a second before. You hear bing, pause, then the scene shifts to him in the elevator. So I had two theories on this. One is, because first of all, the sound in this show is incredibly intentional. So
oh, yes.
You could argue, oh, maybe there's a little bit of discontinuity, or, you know, they did, but sound is so like on point. So there's a reason they did that ding before they showed the scene of Jame walking out of the elevator. So my question is there's two possibilities, right? One is that because that ding always represents somebody going from outie to innie.
Right.
So the question is who turned into an innie there or changed? Because was that where Helly turned into Helena? Or when Jame Egan went down, did he change into somebody else? Because he seemed very different in his little cubicle while he was watching the proceedings than he normally did. He was more alive. I mean, he even screamed fuck, remember? Like he showed emotion, which he really kind of didn't in the fetid Moppet. And, you know, he was very
right.
Weird. So I wonder if maybe, that when he went down, he actually turned back into himself, and that normally he's severed, essentially. Like, his innie was his true person, because why that being is intentional. I don't know what it was for. So that was one thing I noticed.
Mm.
The second thing I noticed in terms of the bad guy, right? You know, they're setting us up that Lumen, you know, is evil, right? You know, again, regardless of the innie survival and so forth, which I agree with, but as Gemma and Audi Mark are leaving the severed floor after he rescues her from Cold Harbor, they get in the elevator, and as they're doing this, the doctor is running after them, right, to try to stop them. They lift the legs of Drummond, and the door closes. The last thing he says is, you're going to kill them all. Now, what if he's right? So we're assuming he's full of shit, because everything we've heard from Lumen seems to be full of shit. I wonder, what if that were true?
Yeah.
So what if everything there's, like, Lumen is literally trying to save humanity for some reason? Because the outside world is weird, right? I mean, there's weird things, 80s cars, all of this other stuff. So, you know, I mean, again, so we talk about good and evil, or right and wrong, but, you know, who's good, who's evil here? What if this doctor is actually correct? And they are, you know, and I don't know what that would look like, but that was something else I noticed. And then, you know, so at that end scene, you know, which I think we need to spend a little bit of time talking about, because, and you and I had talked about it a little bit back and forth in terms of outie versus innie here.
Mm-hmm.
So there's three possibilities at the end of the, which people are up in arms about. People have their strong opinions of, you know, how they felt about that final scene with you know, Gemma,
right,
truly being Gemma outside the door. Innie Mark hesitating between Gemma and not Gemma. And then we see Helly slash Helena slash Helena, there. So those are the three possibilities. I don't know which one would do you want it to be. Like, do you? We don't know. But do you have a? If you had your pick, which would you pick?
Yeah, that's such an interesting and gracious question. Thank you. I think for a simple, easy, nice narrative that makes Rhys the viewer feel really comfortable with the message of the show, I really want Lumen to be the bad guy. I really, really want Lumen to be the bad guy and this to be Innie, Mark, and Helene. I really do like the idea of, and this could be because of my own personal projection and working on the kind of marriage of shadow self and light self and bringing them together and having them walk as friends. And I think that from that feminine archetype perspective, I would really love that journey for Helene. And Helene, and which I'll now use to kind of describe the reintegrated two aspects, and Innie, Mark to be running into Lumen and then be able to take it down somehow with Helena's knowledge of how it works. They're actually now running down the hallway, and because it's Helena, they're going to be able to do something that saves everyone, solves the problem, saves the day. Bing, bang, boom. We're good. As a human who understands that things are really complex and has a lot of appreciation for this show, I think I would also be really disappointed if that's the tack that they take, because that's, we've seen time and time again that this show is not going to take the easy road out and everything has subtle meanings and messages. I think, of course, the anti-capitalist message is not, like anyone watching the show, that message is not going over anyone's head. But I do think there is something to the idea that, like, you can't just burn it all to the ground and expect it to be fixed. Like, we have to make small incremental changes towards good, because starting from zero, like, who's to say the exact same corrupt system can't come again, right? How do you use the things we have learned from Lumen, from the way it's been operated, and try and make it better? I think with
Why do they have to treat the innies like dicks? Like, right. why do they have to be? I mean, like, none of them seem to be, you know, they all seem very innocent, right?
Yeah.
So why not treat them well instead of subjecting them to these, you know, this, you know, the break room and why? I mean, you treat them well and they have a, you know, they enjoy life. You take them on, they have the ability to take them on Ortbos.
Right.
Like, those could be rewards.
And not terrifying like this one.
Right. Right. Exactly. Like with the weird, you know, people pointing and.
Right.
I think it's interesting because, you know, I started there in terms of, wow, you know, I think this is more than Helena, or more than Helly. And I don't know, I've kind of walked back a little bit from that, and here's why. Because I was thinking about it, like, as this season ends, who has the most power in the entire show right now? And I'll make the argument that if this were Innie Helly, so if at the end that it's Innie Helly, it's Helly, you know, full stop, running with, you know, Innie Mark, who is a little bit reintegrated, right? We don't know how far that is, and they left that open. But so initially the thought is, oh my God, what's going to happen to them? Like, oh, all they have to do. But here's the thing I noticed when I rewatched: Jane Egan wants Helly. He thinks Helly is Keir. He sees Keir in Helly. So to me, I would argue that Innie Helly actually has the most power, and by staying down there, she did the best. You know. Gave herself the best position because Jane wants her. Like she's the one he sees Keir in. And again, assuming there's no reason to doubt his true sincerity to the, you know, to Keir and all of that. Like he's a high priest of Keir, he's all in. And he's also the CEO and presumably the liaison to the board through Natalie in some weird ass way that we haven't obviously figured out. So it being any Helly, to me, actually, she may hold more cards than I initially thought.
Yeah.
And the other thing is because they are so good at telegraphing things, like they don't just, like, shit doesn't pop out randomly in the show that I've noticed. I mean, for the most part. And there's been no indication that Helly or Helena have anything to do with reintegration. To me, that would truly be sort of a deus ex machina, right? Where they just popped that out of nowhere. There was no hints of that. I mean, yes, they talked about reintegration, but never in the context of Helly. And yes, you could come up with reasons how, well, you know, they figured it out double time, et cetera, et cetera. To me, that's, you know, that would come out of nowhere. And so upon retrospect, you know, I, and again, it could be, and they can, you know, retcon it and come up with, you know, maybe there's things that we miss that I haven't seen, including the ding that I aforementioned, that, you know, came out of the middle of nowhere. So I don't know. You know, I feel like Helly, you know, given what Jame wants, I mean, so let's assume the spirit of Kira is a thing and it's not just made up.
Right.
And, you know, which, of course, you know, and maybe that's not too far of a leap for us in this world, given, you know, what we, you know, how we live life and our view of spirituality. So if that is such a thing, and Helly, in fact, is the chosen one, you know, I mean, it's almost, is there an Ishmael Isaac comparison here? You know, Ishmael came first, the outie Helly, but Isaac is the chosen one, you know? And I mean, you know, don't forget you have the whole sacrificial lamb, sacrificial goat, right? Which is very similar to the story of Abraham sacrificing Isaac and about to kill him. And it's, no, you know, use this goat. I think it was a ram caught in the thicket. It was is what Abraham then sacrificed instead of Isaac. So and then you also have the symbolic nature of the scapegoat. From Yom Kippur and the one goat goes out into the wilderness, the other goat is slaughtered. And is Gemma the goat that goes out into the wilderness? Because, you know, there's only one goat that was going to get slaughtered. Is Gemma the scapegoat, as they call for the sins of the community? I don't know. There's so much symbolism there, and some of it could be, you know, I'm reading things into it that's not there. But again, if you take the assumption that this whole Kier thing is real in the same, you know, that in the same way a mainstream religion would be real in our world, you know,
right?
I know there's been comparisons to Scientology and things like that to the people to people who practice that, it is real to them. So
yeah,
I mean, it's just it's interesting there, and I don't know, what do you think about that? I threw a lot out there, but my mind is, you know, all over.
I do like the grounding the spirituality of this too into, like, whether or not it's quote unquote real, like a large group of people's belief in something, like, makes it real, you know? So I think that's really important in, like, even season one, we see Cobell literally worshiping to a shrine. Like, this is not, this is absolutely a part of it. I think,
and singing hymns, right? The praise Kier hymn, right? I mean, that's a hymn. You know?
Absolutely.
How is that different from praise God from whom all blessings flow?
Yes. You know?
I mean,
yes.
The same exact sort of thing. So
exactly. I think that's really important because I think it's really easy for viewers to look at kind of illustrations of dogma and immediately see the ridiculousness in it. But it's harder to see how it's like, no, there is a direct one-to-one comparison to what we do in our lives, and we don't feel that that's ridiculous. Like, that we should not pass judgment on these characters in the same way that we don't pass that judgment on ourselves for the beliefs we hold. And I think, of course, there's this capitalist message of, like, the religiosity of work culture, company. So that's all in there too. I think one thing that I'm really thinking about with the ding specifically is Jame walks directly into this cubicle is the way Jame and Kier kind of play off of each other. And if there's some way for that to be, like, I think it's interesting that you said, what if that's been Kier and this is now Jame coming into Jame? My gut instinct was that that's Kier and Jame has been Jame outside. So I think there's also this interesting, like, interplay there. And I do think that Helly has the most power. She has always had a lot of power in the sense that, like, in season one, when she takes the paper cutter and threatens to cut off her fingers and is like, you need to explain these things, otherwise you need to explain to my Audi why she only has two fingers, and then attempts suicide to send a message to her Audi and, like, shows that she is not afraid to go the distance. I do think, too, in you saying, like, Lumen clearly hasn't figured out reintegration. And I think that is a gap in my reintegration thought, that it's like, no, the only... They were all surprised at this idea in season one that Petey had reintegrated at all. And
right, other than Cobell, right? She was the only one who was like, no, they reintegrated, you know?
Yeah.
And everyone Rigabi, else was like, no, no, you know.
Yes, yes. Being able to do that is, like, revolutionary in this technology. So I think that's a really good point. And I do think that, like, if Helly had gone outside, Helena probably wouldn't have gone back in. And that would have been killing Helly. And if Helly stays on the severed floor, and then I guess you could argue that she would, you know, with the overtime contingency or the, like, other aspects of the technology that clearly they can wake people up when they're not just on the severed floor. This could be the end of Helena. Helly could just be Helly. And how would that look? And it's like, does one of them have to die with this kind of Ishmael Isaac? And also, like, prodigal son kind of thing too. That story has always been so frustrating to me that it's like, the son who left and returned gets all of this stuff, but the son who has been there the whole time, it's just like, you're good. But I do think there is something about doubt that hardens your faith, right? Like, when you've come through doubt and you're on the other side, your heels are kind of dug into your faith even more, that it's like, yeah, I've been there. I know what you think. I'm not letting go of this. And so I wonder if we'll actually see this way for Innies through Helly, kind of like forging a new path for the way Innies are treated and being able to revolutionize Lumen as, like, maybe a humanitarian thing that actually can create a place for the Innies that are here to live really good, fruitful lives that aren't horrible, like we saw in season one. And in wanting, like, Audi Mark, wanting any Mark to just, like, go, he would never go back, he would live his life with Gemma, like, it would, Audi Mark was asking any Mark to kill himself for him. It's like, how do you have any right to actually do that? Do you actually have any right to ask another human being to do that for you? Like, there's, of course, lines of consciousness in that. And, like, where does that arise and what is the ethics in that? There's so many follow-up questions, but I think Lumen is obviously being run by terrifying, horrible people. They also have the key to all of these consciousnesses. And when we have that doctor running at the elevator, like you said, and he said, you're going to kill them all. I do think there's something to this, like, what did he mean by them all? My gut instinct was all of the Innies, right? Like, if you shut down Lumen, you are killing all of these Innies that have their own lives, their own consciousnesses, their own experience, that they just don't wake up one day. That seems really wrong. But also, is them all some broader thing? There's this idea of, like, why did Devon end up with Rickon? Like, there's some weirdness there, and all of Rickon's friends being, like, really odd people. It's like there is this through line of, are there more severed people than just what we're led to believe about them working here? So I think we're really moving in the direction of, what is a person what is not a person? And is there a spectrum of selfhood that we see? And at what point do you respect the idea of a self?
Yeah, no, I agreed completely. And, you know, it's interesting to me, you know, we had talked a little bit offline just around, okay, you know, are you team Gemma or are you team Helen?
Right.
And, you know, I think just based on sort of the zeitgeist and what I'd been watching, it seems like more people are team Gemma than team Helly, at least in terms of, I mean, again, and obviously it's complex, but I am curious, you know, what would make one choose, you know, if you had a strong feeling one way or the other, why? Like, what? So for me, I was definitely team Helly. Now, partly because I don't like Audi Mark. I think Audi Mark is an ass.
Yeah, he's kind of a dick.
You know, I mean, and I think it's interesting to contrast how he treated Innie Mark versus how Dylan treated his Innie. In terms of respect, in terms of personhood, in terms of, and you know, I was as I was rewatching this interaction, this 20-minute dialogue between Audi and Innie Mark via the wonderful cinematography and the camcorder.
Brilliant.
And the blue and the red and all of that. I mean, just give me all of it. But you know, I mean, Audi. Even before Innie Mark ever says anything, Audi Mark is telling Innie Mark how he feels. He says, "Oh, your life has been a nightmare, and I'm sorry." You know, and Innie Mark responds, "Well, you know, it really hasn't been that much of a nightmare. Yeah, I mean, there's bad things, but you know, we make it work." And so, and then he immediately ignores. I mean, Audi Mark does, and this is the same thing he did in the flashback episode with Gemma, where he's telling her how she should feel. And so that's a pattern, which, again, I think is a pattern probably you've experienced, I've experienced, we've all experienced. But then I thought about it a little bit. And, you know, we're looking at this, Innie Mark and Audi Mark. From Innie Mark's perspective, at best, Audi Mark is a deadbeat dad that he's never met before, who's coming here and saying, "Hey, son, you need to sacrifice myself so I can get my wife back. Oh, and isn't it cute you have a girlfriend?" Like, that's at best. Like, literally, he doesn't know this person. It is a...
Yeah.
I mean, imagine that. You've never met somebody before. You know they exist. Like, you know you have a dad. All of a sudden, your dad shows up, sends you a letter, and says, "Hey, son, I need you to sacrifice yourself for me so I can get my wife back." I'd be like, fuck you and the horse you rode in on, dude.
Absolutely
like,
not.
And that's at best. Another way to look at it that I thought of is you know, Audi Mark is basically like God to Innie Mark. I mean, he created Innie Mark in some senses. Now, what kind of a God is Audi Mark? You know, basically telling him to sacrifice himself. You know, and then with a lot of, well, you know, yada, 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 you know, we'll figure it out. You know, it doesn't work that way. Well, how does it work? I don't, I don't really know how it works. You have to trust me. No. Like, how is that different than God? You know, I mean, you can't even see the person, right? I mean, in the flesh, like he's only getting this through the camcorder, right? Through the video.
Right.
Like, I mean, it's just, so it's fat. And in either case, you know, and what is the good believer, right? Listens to God. Well, God, I mean, basically, you know, God told Abraham to go sacrifice his son. So he did. You know, that's the model of, you know, I mean, we talked about it last week, you know. Mary was told you're going to have a, you know, you're going to get pregnant by the Holy Spirit. And she accepted, you know, she acquiesced and, you know, and so he's subverting that trope of, you know, again, it's just, and so to me, because I didn't like Audi Mark, it was very hard for me. And furthermore, you know, there was one episode featuring Gemma and admittedly that was a super and incredibly powerful episode, but for me, it wasn't enough to make me care about Audi Mark in terms of who he is. So for me, I was definitely firmly team Helly or Helleny, depending on what ends
right.
up there. But I'm curious how you landed on that.
Yeah, that's so fascinating. I think the camcorder scene is just like, I'm like, I want it to be studied in film classes and script writing classes in symbolism and humanities and philosophy and literature. And like, I want all of our best minds on it. It is like a magnum opus of creative work to me. I think it's so, so beautiful. And Adam Scott just, whoa, like,
yeah.
insane. The very first thing that struck me about that was that Innie Mark was cloaked in red with this fire, and Audie Mark was cloaked in the icy blue. And the idea that Audies had always represented freedom, right? That it's like, oh, your Audi is free, and Lumen was this trapped place in season one. And this is where we're beginning to see, like, is Lumen actually a place where Innies can feel free? Can you find a sense of freedom within a cage? And how are is Audie Mark actually doing exactly what Lumen has always done to Innie Mark as well, right? That Audie Mark is actually now caging Innie Mark, and this weird marriage between the really horrible and abusive aspects of Lumen and the really horrible aspects of the Audies, thinking that, well, Innies aren't actually people, right? That's kind of what it all comes back to. We're not treating them like people. We are treating them like machines, like unsophisticated animals that need to be like conditioned in this certain way. And that's where you get like the break room, right? So that you can drill this into their brains, because they're not people. So there's nothing that you need to have like sympathy or empathy around with this. And so there's almost this split between Lumen now, and Audies are kind of coming into this, like, they're no longer representing freedom. They're representing this restriction. And in the idea of the Audi being God, that's so fascinating. Because I think, too, even in your example of, like, asking, like a deadbeat dad coming back and asking a son, it kind of mirrors God and Jesus, right? Like, hey, son, you're my son. You were born into this. You have no idea whatsoever. You didn't have a choice, but you're going to do this. You're going to die on the cross. It's going to be really horrible, actually. It's going to be torturous. But don't worry, you're saving all of humanity forever. And it's like, I didn't ask for that. What if I just want to live my life? What if I want to keep turning water into wine? That sounds way more fun than continuing to do all of this. And I wonder if there is this kind of moment when Mark chooses Heli in the end that is kind of like Jesus getting off the cross, that is kind of like, why do I have to be the one to sacrifice myself? And also, why is this sacrifice worthy to begin with? Why is that the thing that is inherently good? That choice is the good one.
Right. Yeah. Well, so, even to go further on that, is not only is he being asked, so, you know, Jesus was asked to sacrifice himself to save the world. This is actually even worse than that. This is not only sacrifice yourself, but all of the other innies in order to save one person. So it's actually the opposite. It's not even, hey, sacrifice yourself to save the world. This is sacrifice everyone you've ever known in order to save my wife, basically, is what that
this
is.
This person so you just to, do not and, know. And
now, there is that interesting similarity of, I mean, if you think about, you know, Jesus, what he's going to do, and assuming he was man, so didn't really know what was going on. Basically, you know, hey, trust me. This was a huge trust me thing, right? In the same way Audie Mark was like, no, you have to trust me. You know, I mean, Jesus presumably was like, no, you know, God is like, yeah, you got to trust me. You know, and so he's like, not my will, thy will be done. But does he know he's going to be resurrected? You know, again, assuming as the story goes, like, how, you know, so he's making that ultimate sacrifice, not really knowing. I mean, it's one thing if you know you're going to be resurrected. All right. Yeah, this sucks. It's, you know, definitely a lot of pain, you know, but when you don't know that, it's just fascinating, those two.
I would also maybe pushing back on that just a little bit, because I totally agree with you about the, like, he is being asked to kind of kill all of the innies. But I think in Audie Mark's paradigm, there is this, like, but you're saving something because you're ending this horrible company that would continue to do horrible things to all of these other people, right? Like, you are saving, like, humanity in a certain sense. And in this, like, you will be reborn, Jesus doesn't know how that's going to work. And when Innymark asks Audimark, he's like, yeah, I don't know how it's going to work, but it'll happen. You'll be reintegrated. Don't worry. You'll come back. And it's like, how? Why? Why would you do that? You wouldn't. And of course, I think this is just such a fascinating, like, example. I don't know if this is fully, like, built into the script of Severance at all, but it really is, or built into, like, the ideas behind it. But I do think there is almost, it calls into question what the honorable choice is and who are you trying to save to begin with. And even if something was created out of something that was really bad, that doesn't mean that the creation itself is bad, right? It's like, and it doesn't mean that all of these people deserve to die. I think in terms of like what team, I was really torn. And I'm like, on one hand, I do think Audimark is a little bit of a dick, but also I'm like, the trauma that that was probably like, and the trauma of the pregnancy that him and Gemma were trying to work on together, and then that coupled with losing her, it's like that, I do have sympathy for how that would turn anyone into their worst self. And Innymark in a lot of ways is like, Mark is at his best. He's optimistic. He's childlike. He's innocent. And seeing both of those things, it's like choosing Helly also almost seems like choosing some sort of joy, choosing something that feels really, it does. Audimark is kind of like, oh, your little schoolgirl crush with Helly. But it's like, isn't there something beautiful about that? Isn't there something beautiful about being able to live in that world without heartbreak, without all of the trauma that choosing Gemma would come with? Not that that's a good reason to run away from the hard work of that, but Innymark doesn't really know that. He only knows his heart. And so I think, for me, it is this really, it's a split between the human psyche in as many ways as it is, that's like, do you choose to forget all of the hard things, like ignorance is bliss kind of, for joy and innocence that is so worthwhile and deserves to be saved and preserved? But also, do you like choose history and hard work and working in a relationship that you've built something through, and not just leaving when the going gets tough? Of course, Innymark making this choice, I think it's obvious that he picked Helly. I don't think there's any world in which he doesn't, because yeah, it's Innymark.
And I would argue the minute that Audimark called her Helleny was the minute that he was like, you know, no, I'm going to do what I'm going to do. Like that to me, just watching his body language, watching and how he responded to it, you know, no, her name's Helly, which you'd know if you really gave a shit about me.
Yeah.
You know, but you know, what's kind of interesting, you know, I was thinking of this as well, is they've kind of set up the reverse trolley problem, right? Right now, the trolley is on track to hit one person. You know, there's a person on the tracks, and that's Gemma, right? And basically, Audimark is asking Innymark to switch the track to not just kill one person, but to kill a whole bunch of people and himself. So, like, normally the trolley problem is oh, you're going to hit five people if you do nothing. If you switch the track, you'll hit one person. Again, this is the opposite of that. And it all, I guess, boils down to, is Innymark a person? You know, is he a person? Because that, if you treat him as not a person, then the decision is easy. Well, this is, you know, if it was the choice to kill 10 dogs or 10, you know, name an animal, 10 bugs, 10 whatever, who aren't people, then the choice is obvious. Yes, you a human being is worth more than the life of a plant or an insect. And I'm not saying that it is or isn't, but if Innymark and all of these other innies are people, then yeah, I mean, you're really, it really is sort of a, you know.
If that is the thing, to kind of go back to what you were saying earlier about the discourse online, I actually haven't seen much around like which side people are on in that sense, like Team Gemma or Team Helly. But I do wonder if that kind of is a dividing line is this idea that, like, even us viewers think of Innies in a certain way that is less than a full human, that is consciousness that is somehow not as fully expressed as an outie. And if that really is what it comes down to, what do we constitute as a person?
Totally.
I think within that too, like, I have really just kind of moved forward with the assumption that innies are people. And I think you have too, that it's like, oh yeah, of course they have this full life, even though it's all within this workplace. But what do you think about that? Do you think innies are, I think I would argue, yes, innies are just as much people as outies are. Where do you fall on that? And what do you think most people see that as?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, and to me, this brings up the Twitter piece that I shared with you that we sort of talked about offline, which I'll bring up here. It's, and we'll, I think, link to the tweet so that people can see it.
But yes.
It's by a gentleman named Darren Mooney, and he says, the fact that so many people seem to be siding with outie Mark over innie Mark in the Severance finale is very much the point the show is making. It's easy to extend sympathy to the oppressed in the abstract and then to drop it once their existence becomes an inconvenience. Mm. And, you know, I think that's so powerful. And I think that's how I see it, because I do see the innies as people. Without question, I see them as individuals, as I see them as different people than their outies, frankly. And I do think the deadbeat dad is an accurate comparison to sort of how I see it. Like, I know there's another person. I've just never met them. They don't really talk to me. They're a deadbeat dad. You know, every now and then I get a check from them or, you know, a birthday card via this weird, you know, DVD sort of CD-ROM package, maybe, you know, and, I don't know, you know, it's so for me, this tweet really did hit home for me, because I agree with that. Like, I'm pat myself on the back and sprain my shoulder doing so, but, you know, I kind of always felt that way. So, you know, but, you know, to me, I think for folks who, you know, were on the other side strongly, I mean, and again, it's complex and there's no right or wrong here. That's why we're talking about it, and why it's so fascinating, because it's perfectly valid to side with outie Mark and Gemma and say, no, you know, he was there first. You know, Gemma, they've been together for a while. But one thing I would point out, yes, I mean, certainly Mark and Gemma were together for far longer than innie Mark and Helly. However, I will point out that pretty much every minute of innie Mark's life, he was with Helly, you know, after they met. Like, literally, they were never apart from each other. You know, they woke up, the minute they got out of the elevator and got to MDR, she's there. They're there until they leave. So if you talk about percentage of one's life that the other person is involved in, the ratio of, like, time apart from time together, I might argue that innie Mark has spent more time with Helly than outie Mark has spent with Gemma. Again, I don't know. You could do the math, I guess, whatever. That doesn't matter. It's thinking about this complex ecosystem, you know, and one thing I noticed too in that end scene, which I feel like we should talk about, and just in terms of cinematography and the beauty of that scene where they're running and the red lights are going. It's interesting what I noticed, and I don't even know if that means anything. I just noticed it. I didn't notice it in the first watching, but when the lights are strobing and sort of moving, particularly in the beginning when, like, it goes dark and just this little, you know, the this was like breadcrumbs leading them to MDR so he could finish the file. But as they're at the end, when they're running, they are going in the opposite direction that the lights are going. So the emergency, you know, I realized that those red lights were like emergency exits, exit to the, you know, go. They were actually running against that stream at the end. And then it fades to sort of film and then the sort of painting, you know. So again, just the symbolism there, you know, running into danger. You know, when you're supposed to be evacuating, you're supposed to be leaving, they're running into the danger, essentially, the two of them together.
Also, that the lights are red moving one way. Are they running into the blue, into more captivity, into the belly of the beast that has been the thing holding them back. My reaction, I really do love that tweet that you brought up. I think it's really, really profound and important in a lot of ways, especially with a lot of the oppression that we see all around us today, right? It's like, it's really easy in the abstract to... It always makes me think of the 21 Pilots lyric that I'm like, my middle school emo phase is coming out. But there's in one song, it says, like, metaphorically, I'm the man, but literally, I don't know what I'd do. And it's like, it's so true. Like, in abstract, in metaphor, we're all like, oh, yeah, I would totally do this and it would be great and I'd be so good. But it's like, in the literal, at the end of the day, you're going to look out for yourself. You have this instinct of survival. And with dropping people who are oppressed the minute that it gets inconvenient, my gut instinct with that too was not just other people that are oppressed, but this idea of the pieces of ourselves that we have oppressed as well. And I think that... there is this kind of, not only is there something in like any Mark that is threatening to Audi Mark, because it is a side of him that probably feels like it's hurt him, right? It's like that blind optimism is the thing that made any pain in his life so hard and so tragic. But it's really easy to say, but I love all parts of myself. I love the part of me that's optimistic, even though it hurts to be let down. I love the part of me that bares its teeth when I'm scared, even though I don't like that gut reaction maybe isn't perfect or pretty. And when we're sitting and journaling or meditating or working on these things, at least maybe this is just a self-report. I don't want to project anything onto our listeners, but it's like, it's really easy to be like, of course I love myself. All of my edges and sharp parts and teeth and, warts and all, right? It's like, yeah, all of these things, I can see all the ways in which they make me exactly who I am. But you step out of the front door at the beginning of your day, and what are you still leaving behind? Even though you say you love all those things, as soon as it gets hard to love those things, it's really easy to just press them down. As soon as it gets hard to like actually be there for yourself, do the real work of self-care that is like, yeah, this is going to mean some people aren't going to like me and that's okay. That doesn't make me a bad person. Or yeah, that means I have these thoughts and that is what I think, period. Yeah. And it's going to make your life harder in some ways. That doesn't mean that you are bad or that those choices are bad. And I think that is the area that a lot of us drop that self-love, because it gets hard to do. And I would almost argue that this finale is asking us to not see Lumen as good or bad, not see Audi Mark or any Mark as good or bad, not see the choice of Gemma or Helly as good or bad, but to see all of them as choices that we make as human beings, you know, and we're forced to make hard choices. But at the end of the day, you got to choose.
Yeah. And I think I love that idea of parts, because we occasionally talk about parts and other things like that. You know, it just strikes me how Dylan is such a perfect representation of how in an ideal world we would treat these parts of ourselves, because he was so honest with his innie. And it was like, number one, fuck you. You know, how, you know, this is messed up, dude. There's an egregious breach of trust. Number two, I get it. Like, she's really awesome. Yeah. But then number three, I love you. Like, that was sort of the message. Like, you know, quit if you want, but I'm kind of, if I'm really honest, I'm glad you're there, because it's really cool to know that there's this part of me that, you know, Gretchen loves, and I want her to see me the way she sees you. And I love that. It's just such a perfect picture of integration, Like, it we is. Talk about reintegration, but that to me was the most integrate, you know, the most integration or reintegration we've seen on the show was demonstrated by Dylan, which again leads me to believe he's actually the hero of the show. He's the one who actually gets shit done. Like, I mean, honestly, like, he is totally the boss of the show who gets, you know, less airtime.
Let's talk about the vending machine, man. Like, so epic. So epic, because of course it's like we're expecting, like, okay, when is Dylan going to come and grab the door handle and help Helly, right? And it's like, no, I don't even need that. I'm just going to fucking ram an entire vending machine through the door. Like, electric energy.
That was incredible,
And I completely agree. Like, can you imagine truly, like, sitting down and, like, writing a letter to the darkest parts of yourself that started with, fuck you. Like, I hate, I'll own it. Like, my fear, and fear has been such a big thing that I've been trying to integrate recently. And it's like, fuck you. Fuck you for being afraid. Fuck you for having these fears to begin with. Fuck you for making me feel afraid. I also get it. Life is scary. Life is so scary. But also, I love you. Thank you for trying to protect me. And you don't need to go anywhere, because I understand why you're there and I need your protection. And you also need me to be brave, right? It's like, we need each other. And I just completely agree with what you just said. I think that's such a beautiful note.
Yeah, well, and talking, and even, you know, going on that and talking about this idea of, you know, Mark's, you know, any Mark is outie Mark's creation. Well, in another sense, that fear you're talking about, this part of you that's afraid, that's also your creation.
Yeah.
You created that part of you. You are the creator of it. And who else can integrate but the creator? If you were the creator, you know, you can, you know, you it's up to you, essentially, you know, the integrated you. And just, again, to realize that and to be able to say, hey, fuck you, you know, I don't like you, but I get it. Like, you're my creation. I love you, because everything I create is good. No matter what it is good. And that's love. And that's basically, you know, to me, what Dylan said, right? Is like, I created you, you know, you're good. Like, you're awesome. I love you. I mean, it almost brings me tears to just, if we could all just channel our Dylan, like, honestly, with ourselves, you know, treat us the way Dylan treated himself. And again, you just contrast that, you know, if Audi Mark had taken that same approach with any Mark, would it have changed anything? I don't know. But it would have had a much better chance.
Well, and I think even in you saying this is the first form of true integration we're seeing, there is something really interesting that they talk in the camcorder scene with reintegration that's like, isn't reintegrating actually, like, I'd be 2 years of your life. You would be, like, what, 35 years of your life, 40 years of your life.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. And so in some way, even though, I'm still a part of you, like, I'm not really, it's still burying everything that any Mark is, but actually by Audi Dylan allowing any Dylan to choose, to be, to live, that is actually integrating. Like, the in-world reintegration isn't really integration in the way that we're talking about it, in terms of, like, integrating these different parts. And so that is really a fascinating, like, combo. One thing I want to make sure we go back to as well with all of this is the kind of role of the feminine in all of this. I think that there is this kind of in, like, the innocence and naivety of any Mark, right? It's like there's more feminine energy there than in Audi Mark. In Cobell, we see this, like, extremely strong feminine, and Natalie is, like, the perfect example of, like, a perfectly wrapped, beautiful person with a bow and no cracks, like, no cracks on the outside. And then I think Gemma as a character really drove home the point for me of, like, the connection between capitalism and patriarchy, in that Gemma not being able to procreate, in not being able to produce something, she is like a bad woman. She is not of use. In capitalism, it's like workers are supposed to create something. You're only as worthy as what you create, as the dollars you can generate for the company. Yeah. So
what have you done for me lately? You know, and with Cobell, you know, and what I thought is interesting in terms of Cobell, if you watch the intro, right, the intro scene, the
like opening sequence.
Yeah, the opening sequence. Sorry, I couldn't.
You're okay.
it's a brain fart. You know, Cobell is watching over the whole thing. There's a figure of her with the storybook, with the goats and the innies that, you know. And so again, it shows. I mean, and she was the one who created this whole procedure. So again, it talks about a feminine creator. Like, yes, Keir took credit, or Jane took credit for it, but a woman, the feminine, the divine feminine, created this whole process. Which again, I think, and it does show Cobell as such a powerful woman. Now, I am curious what she's going to do with her notebook, what that actually does for her. It's something I'm still not. I don't think we have any ideas on, but we need to explore this more. I think we have more to say on this. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, totally. There is just so much more there. So
I feel like we only touched like the literal tip of the iceberg, if you will, right, in terms of what we could talk about. So
we'll put a pin in this for now. Yeah. And we'll return to this idea. And hopefully once season 3 is out, we can even come back to it another time. So absolutely. Yeah. Thank you everyone for listening, for being here. Let us know if you're a fan of Severance, what you think in the comments down below. If you have any thoughts about what we shared here, we would love to hear it. And Dennis, thank you for your thoughts as always.
I love the, I just love all the symbolism and the fact that we can parse through it and get new ideas out of it. You know, so it's all about synthesis, right? Like, really, really cool stuff. So I hope our listeners are as excited as we are.
Bow Down is a weekly podcast from the Coherent Collective that explores esoteric and empowered feminism.
Please subscribe to Bow Down wherever you may be listening. And if you enjoyed the episode, please leave us a like, a 5-star rating, and a review. And if there's anyone you think would enjoy this episode, or maybe just needs to hear it, please share it.
If you want to stay up to date on all things Bow Down, you can follow the Cohere Collective on any social media platform at the Cohere Collective, and check out other content and offerings at www.thecoherecollective.com.
If you're interested in working with Reese to find and pursue your purpose, I encourage you to head to www.thecoherecollective.com/life-coaching.
If you're interested in working with Dennis to shed your mask and embrace your desires, you can email Dennis at dennis@theheartstoybox.com.
A huge thank you to Jack Corbett for Bow Down's music. You can find him on Instagram at j.corbe. Thank you all for joining us today. We're so glad you're here.
And as always, we hope you feel like you are living more coherently. And until next time, love.